This recording is the property of the Winter Grun Foundation and cannot be used, quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast. Thought the foundation's express permission. The anthropology section for this New York Academy of Sciences lecture series for October 22nd, 2012. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Rachel Watkins. Presentation is The Normative Analytical Frameworks and Studies of Identified Skeletal Collections, Some Considerations.
This is my traditional hello. We've got a great speaker, Rachel Watkins, tonight, who's competing with Obama and Romney. And we all understand that the liftoff is at 9 p.m. So what we're going to try to do is wrap it up as efficiently as possible. So if you want to rush home for the debate. But you remember there's also YouTube and lots of other opportunities.
And it's really more the spin than the content anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So Jeff will, Rudy will do it.
Hi, I just want to thank you for coming. Thank Rachel for being here. Jeff is going to introduce Rachel more properly. I just want to say that, like I always do, that we like to know who's attending the events, whether you're a repeat attender or it's your first time, if you could repeat it, whatever, I'm tired. Please let us know that by signing one of these sheets. Thank you.
Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce Rachel Watkins, who is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at American University. Rachel received her PhD from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in anthropology. Her research focuses on the biological and social history of African Americans living in the 19th and 20th century urban United States, and she is actively involved in an ongoing research project on the W. Montague Cobb Skeletal Collection, which is made up of D.C. residents who died in the city between 1930 and 1969. Among her numerous publications are some really interesting titles: Biohistorical Narratives of Racial Difference, which is published in Current Anthropology, just out, really. Variations in Degenerative Joint Disease and Cause of Death Within a Skeletal Population in the International Journal of Osteoarchaeology.
And it's an excellent paper.
Not in the fire case. Leslie, all of these are excellent papers. And a very interesting piece that speaks across the disciplines, which I think is actually a hallmark of Rachel's work, is Knowledge from the Margins, which is a kind of widely cited American anthropological work published in American Anthropologist in 2007. Those are just three examples of the kind of work that she's done. She's done a ton of work. She's extremely well known. She's one of the friendliest physical anthropologist to cultural anthropology that we have known I've known her for years, and she's one of the people who talks really well across subfields and subdisciplines, and that's one of the reasons that we thought it would be a good idea to bring her here, and that's one of the reasons, amongst many others, including her incredibly important work, that it's a thrill to have her here today. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, this is obviously the place to be. That debate is just a little bit of political drama that doesn't actually have any significance on what happens in America. So this is where it's at. All right. So I really like to help you all join me in welcoming Rachel. Her talk tonight is called Normative Analytic Frameworks and Studies of Identified Skeletal Collections, Some Considerations. Welcome, Rachel.
Jeff, Rudy, Leslie, everyone for inviting me here. Thanks also for coming out on the night of the debate. I'm hoping, as a biological anthropologist who attempts to straddle the fence, that we can have a bit of debate about what I'm talking about before you go home and watch the debate between Obama and Romney. What I'm going to speak about today is the product of work that I'm engaging in with Dr. Jennifer Muller of Ithaca College, born of mutual interests that brought us to a common place from which we began to work together on developing and implementing a model for a critical, humanistic, biocultural study of the W. Montague Cobb Skeletal Collection. Now, the Skeletal Collection, which is housed at Howard University, which is made up of individuals who died in D.C. between 1932 and 1969, was the subject of both of our dissertations, hers focusing on trauma associated with the biological consequences of poverty and inequality, and mine focusing on degenerative joint disease and identifying different segments within the population. Most recently, Jennifer and I have added a joint curatorial appointment at Howard University's W. Montague Cobb Biological Anthropology Laboratory to our collaboration. I also have to acknowledge that our work was originally intended to be shared with our colleague, Mark Mack, who was laboratory director of the Cobb Laboratory, who was laboratory director for the Cobb Laboratory from the beginning of the New York African Burial Ground Project, of which I'm sure you all are familiar, until his untimely death in May of this year, which is why Jennifer and I have the joint interim curatorial appointment right now. Our intended work with Mark Mack, whose interest in the protection and, if possible, repatriation of African-American skeletal remains and funerary objects, will continue in the name of exploring new possibilities for this critical humanistic approach to studying human biology that we're putting together. To provide you with an overview of what I'm going to talk about, or most of what I'll talk about, depending on what time allows for, I'm going to present what I consider to be my intellectual lineage, which will also introduce you to some of the methodological and theoretical context of African-American biohistory. And I'm also going to provide an overview of existing biocultural frameworks for understanding human biology, including foundational points of interrogation, which are kind of the jumping, the board from which we spring and do the stuff we're doing now. Also presenting differential experiences of poverty and inequality, and then finally presenting to you our new or newer points of interrogation, which are the enduring chronological, temporal, ethno-racial, and distributional normativities that are still at work in bioanthropological studies today. And I trust all that will be explained later. Now, regarding this term, critical and humanistic, or a critical humanistic study of human biology, this term isn't one we coined ourselves. Scholars such as Alan Goodman, Deborah Martin, George Armelagos, Jonathan Marks, Roseanne Higgins, Joyce Siriani, Leslie Rankin-Hill, Brooke Thomas, Michael Blakey, many of whom are known for writing about human biology from a political economic perspective, have been doing so since the 1980s. I historically situate this work along a continuum that includes 19th and early 20th century interrogations of race and racial typology, as well as explorations of the relationship between human biology and social context. In briefly presenting that work, I'll also present to you what I identify as my intellectual lineage. Here you have a picture up in the top corner of William Montague Cobb, who was the first African-American to receive a doctorate in biological anthropology in 1932 from Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio. He studied under T. Wingate Todd, who was considered to be a progressive bioanthropologist for his time. Cobb was arguably among the first to demonstrate a commitment to biocultural integration, I'm not getting to the interrogation yet, and racial justice. And I point this out because Cobb, interestingly, is someone who did not consider himself to be a descendant of Boas. He did not consider himself to be a part of the Boasian school. His position was, as an anthropologist, you should be conversant in all aspects of the discipline and all of the subdisciplines to the extent possible. And so he, from the very beginning, was interested in looking at human biology as a lens for looking at social context. Some of his publications that highlight that: in 1935, Municipal History from Anatomical Records was published in Scientific Monthly. This is a paper that's actually based on the skeletal collection that was at Case Western Reserve University that was the subject of his dissertation. And in this paper, he outlines how it is that he goes about looking at the ecological phenomena, what he referred to as ecological phenomena that bear upon human biology. And that was his particular way of talking about social context, because in the paper he talks about where they lived, the socioeconomic conditions, so on and so forth. He also published in 1936 a monograph that kind of outlined his process of putting together the laboratory at Howard University, which he did to the end of creating something that somewhat replicated the laboratory at Case Western Reserve. He wanted to create a laboratory space complete with a reference skeletal collection that would allow African Americans to enter into this discussion about racial typology and race biology. And then probably one of his most well-known papers, Race and Runners, was published in the Journal of Health and Physical Education in 1936. And this is the paper, for those of you who might not be aware, that is based on his examination of Jesse Owens after Jesse Owens returned from the Olympics, because since Jesse Owens beat so many of the Aryans, right, the assumption was, oh, black folks must have some extra muscle or extra something or different something or other that caused him to be able to do this. And so in Cobb's examination of Jesse Owens' musculoskeletal structure, he found that Jesse Owens actually resembled a more European or Caucasoid type a skeleton and musculature than Negroid type. So there you have it. Part of this lineage as well is general, kind of outside of the context of anthropology or physical anthropology, writings against race. Many of the folk who are instrumental in writing about biocultural approaches to the study of human biology will cite Frederick Douglass in his speech that he gave, ironically, at Case Western Reserve. So much of this seems to revolve around that place, The Claims of the Negro Ethnologically Considered, in which he kind of systematically took on a lot of the prevailing studies of the time, waging a really nuanced and thorough critique of these approaches to looking at human biology from a racial perspective. And that, you see, was in 1854. I also have here W.E.B. Du Bois and his Atlanta University Sociological Laboratory. We know that he is responsible for tons of works that are that involved writing against race, so many of the essays in Dusk of Dawn. Also, for those of you who might not be into sci-fi like I am, I'd like to direct you to a short story that he wrote in 1920 called The Comet, which also kind of takes on these same ideas in a very interesting and creative way. And then finally, I have here Caroline Bondé, who was the first African-American woman to receive a graduate degree in physical anthropology. She actually was a student of Ernest Houghton's. Her thesis was called A Study of Some Negro-White Families in the U.S. And even though we know Ernest Houghton was someone who could be considered a racialist in terms of his approach to studying human biological variation, his student, Caroline Bondé, actually wrote a thesis that counteracted these ideas that Negro-white families, or that this admixture of Negroes with whites, yielded some sort of inherent betterment on their part in terms of the success, their smarts, what have you. There were these prevailing ideas that mixed or Negro-white individuals were smarter and more successful simply because of the white admixture. And she, in her study, highlighted how it is actually the fact that these people had ties to their white families, which provided them with a certain amount of mobility that made life easier for them. Just to sum up some of the characteristics of this writing against race within this lineage, no particular adherence to an academic discipline or purely biological or social perspective in analyses and critiques, which we saw with Cobb, who identified as a bioanthropologist, as well as Du Bois and Douglass and Bondé as well. Their writing was not contingent upon the emergence of a particular anthropological perspective. I highlight that again, noting that Cobb was not someone who considered himself to be a product of the Boasian school. And their work was a matter of expressing the multiple facets of their identities as scholars, activists, and being African Americans who experienced racism. So what I think we have here, and it's very important, is a lineage that kind of foundationally shows how it is that you can have a political agenda and work towards social justice without compromising academic rigor. I think it's a very important point to make here. I end here with the New York African Burial Ground Project, which kind of represented a culmination of sorts of the ideas that were expressed in the earlier works that I highlighted. Some of the things that the project was known for was a commitment to critical theory, an integration of critical theory into the work as it relates to organizational schemes, so on and so forth, a commitment to activist scholarship and political engagement, as well as an accountability to what is referred to as a descendant community. More generally, the New York African Burial Ground Project took into account many of the elements of a critical humanistic human biology that the scholars I mentioned, Blakey and others, wrote about, including a multicultural, which is something I didn't mention before, a multicultural competence, or what has been referred to as a multicultural competence, to conduct research on African descendant populations, as well as a non-racialized understanding of population affinities and integration of history, philosophy, art, and archaeology. As such, the African Burial Ground Project reflected a significant operationalization of a humanistic approach to studying human biology and laid a foundation for critical reflection upon and critical analysis of future bioanthropological methodologies. Now, having been influenced by the project, and in my case, this is directly so, as I was a student at Howard during the research phase of the project, our graduate and postgraduate research and writing, in our postgraduate research and writing, we continue to explore possibilities for community engagement, integrating bioanthropological studies with ongoing research in other subdisciplines, and doing so in a way that makes biological anthropology relevant to contemporary discussions regarding social justice. My interest in exploring the notion of normativity, for instance, as it relates to this work, grew out of my interest in developing ways of destabilizing the binaries that are typically used in historical treatments of American physical anthropology. For instance, this notion of categorizing certain bioanthropologists from the 19th and 20th centuries as racist or non-racist, kind of an oversimplified boundary in many ways that I talk about in the Biohistorical Narratives of Racial Difference paper, as well as in scientific investigations of African-American population samples. There's very often, or it's very common to have in these comparative studies, one population sample is considered to be healthy and the other one non-healthy. So again, an oversimplified binary. As well as how and why these binaries persist as we develop more complex understanding of racial formations in science, as well as the social context of health and disease. In addition to being a part of a department made up of cultural anthropologists who identify as queer theorists or utilize queer theory, at the 2005 American Anthropological Association meetings, in a session titled The Biology of Experience, bioanthropologist R. Brooke Thomas suggested a number of areas in which biocultural anthropology might be of use to other subdisciplinary specialties in the future. Queer theory was actually included among the areas mentioned. And in keeping with bioanthropologists, there was this very convoluted, very cumbersome diagram. We love to do these diagrams of biocultural interrelationships that have arrows and stuff flying all over the place. So it was replete with that as well. There is indeed a historical context for coupling bioanthropology and queer theory as the ideological power associated with naturalized categories of race and sexuality emerged through one another. and both bioanthropologists and queer theorists have written about this. Also, African descendant skeletal samples to which we have access were in part situated as research subjects based on a perceived deviance from normative sexualities, as well as constituting a deviant racial type. As it relates to understanding the complexities of social embeddedness of the population samples we study and how this research can be used towards social justice ends, exposing veiled structures of inequality involves rendering visible how it is that particular formations such as space, time, and race gain and maintain the appearance of stability and permanence. So that I see as a context for including or kind of engaging queer theory in our work. Now, while I was engaged in these sorts of explorations, Jennifer was engaged in her own thinking around the situation of our data sets as temporally and spatially static entities. So in our own individual ways, we were kind of looking at what we didn't refer to as normativities, but in looking at some of the literature, we realized that is what we were looking at. And so when we came across pieces like Time Binds by Freeman, those really resonated with us. And so what we're attempting to do now is develop these kind of interrogative spaces in which we look at how it is bioanthropologists do bioanthropology, how it is that we can add to these kind of critical and humanistic studies that we put together, and what they're actually going to look like. Because one of the points that we always raise with one another is that Blakey and Marx and many folks have written about these components, and certainly the Burial Ground Project did reflect an operationalization of some of this stuff, but the critical and humanistic approaches to human biology have mainly existed in terms of writing about what could be. And so we really wanted to go about the process of developing a model to see what it is that a critical humanistic study of human biology actually looks like and how you actually go about implementing it. So with that said, the common questions Jennifer and I had around continued methods of organizing data served as an inroad to our joint exploration of the descriptive labels and categories in need of further critical examination. And specifically, we identified the temporal, spatial, distributional, and ethno-racial normativities that I mentioned before. Now, why is this important? It's important because arguably, and how many bioanthropologists are in here? Me, two? Oh, good, see, very few of us, right? Why is this important? Well, arguably, the contemporary understanding of American physical anthropology is primarily one of its history, the role that the discipline played in the construction of the race concept and the production of scientific knowledge and authority based on racial typology. However, as mentioned in my earlier reference to the work of Goodman and others, the most recent intellectual turns in biological anthropology include non-typological approaches to studying human variation, such as differences in health and disease patterns within and between samples. These turns also involve complicating the social contexts in which health and disease patterns are observed, meaning social contexts in which people are embedded are considered complex formations rather than naturalized, taken for granted conditions. In doing so, biological anthropology has attempted to demonstrate its relevance to addressing social problems as well as critical approaches to anthropological study. And this, in our opinion, is where bioanthropology stands poised to be more involved in interdisciplinary work, not just in the form of bioanthropologists doing historical treatments, but actually integrating our work on skeletal remains, on hard tissues and soft tissues of various sorts, into larger agendas within anthropology. Now, I don't mean to overgeneralize this intellectual turn within the discipline or these turns within the discipline, because absolutely biological anthropologists position themselves in various ways, with various political orientations, with various considerations of the political implications of their work. At the extreme, there remain a number of scholars that indeed reify racial difference and continue to do so. I'm sure that we all read, for instance, or heard about the recent passing of psychologist J. Philippe Rushton, known for his studies equating race and intelligence as well as genitalia size and all of that, as well as the direct and indirect endorsement of his work by biological anthropologists such as Henry Harpending. But returning to bioanthropology's attempt to contribute to critical approaches to anthropological study and social change, these recent turns involve recognizing that science is inextricably tied to social practice. This recognition of the role that ideology has played and continues to play in shaping the discipline has led to an increased consideration of the importance of social theory to the growth of the discipline, especially as it relates to developing into a more critical and humanistic science. Now, I'm going to highlight, some of the tenets or points of interrogation that were the basis of these critical biocultural perspectives beginning in the 1980s. And I'm doing so, to illustrate the precedent for the points of interrogation that are the focus of the work that Jen and I are doing. So I'm doing so, as I mentioned, to illustrate the precedent for the points of interrogation that are the focus of our work. Before I get into the tenets, kind of joining our current work on the Cobb collection with the lineage that I placed before you, I wanted to just kind of give you in visual form some of the specs on the skeletal collection we study, which, as I said, is housed in a laboratory named after William Montague Cobb at Howard University in D.C. that dates between 1932 and 1969. Those are actually the dates of death. People died between those dates. At present, the skeletal number is 650. The documentary number, however, which reflects the original number of skeletal remains in the collection, is around 900. Right? And so in the spirit of attempting to kind of build on these biocultural perspectives on human biology, I mentioned Jennifer and I have engaged in work looking at patterns of activity, stress, trauma, and cause of death, and looking at variations in those things, not just between the Cobb collection and other samples, but within the sample itself. There are, for instance, individuals in the individuals who were residents of the city poorhouse, as well as individuals who lived in the general population. And while, for instance, since it is part of a collective skeletal sample that is housed in one place, people might treat that entire sample as this collective, we kind of argue that it is not. If you have individuals who were poorhouse residents and you have folks who lived in the general population, that constitutes some significant difference. And so we went about exploring those variations or how those variations might show up in health and disease patterns. Expanding the cultural context, mainly by looking at the relationship of extra and extra local factors to health. So looking at what the local history of D.C., the local social history of D.C. was like and how that impacted the daily lives of the individuals in the collection, as well as extra local factors, such as the kind of generalized experience of discrimination and racism that was that were happening across the country. One thing that we're working to do, going back to this documentary end of roughly 900 and the skeletal end of 650, is reconsolidating this human archive. When we look at this collection and what it represents, we have to consider the fact that the collection itself is made up of the individuals as they're represented in both the skeletal and the documentary record. And just because we don't have skeletal remains for all of the individuals doesn't mean that they should be left out. That's kind of a what we consider to be a problematic construction of the population sample. So we're attempting to, and in part, these interrogations are part of the process, we're attempting to reconsolidate the archive. And you see here I have in parentheses infants as well as absent skeletons, because there are actually a substantial number of infant files that we have, meaning that Cobb actually collected infant skeletal remains and that they were part of the original sample. Finally, we're also exploring possibilities for incorporating repatriation and reburial into our critical and humanistic study involving the community. One of the questions that we're kind of grappling with now is, should repatriation and reburial be an entrenched component of critical and humanistic studies? What is the point, perhaps, of continuing to have skeletal remains housed in laboratories, in cabinets? Right. So moving on to these particular tenets, I feel like one of my students is looking at some of these tenets of the biocultural interface that were kind of foundational to the biocultural studies that began in the 1980s. Tenet number one, health variations are a reflection of the dynamic interplay between adaptation and stress. Now, this represents a point of departure from a historical understanding of human biological variation as a product of some sort of functional adaptation to one's physical environment. And this is something that historically was connected to, for instance, what we refer to as the new physical anthropology of the 1950s. It was still somewhat of a focus on looking at all variation outside of the context of racial typology, but really focusing more on looking at variation as adaptive rather than looking at this interplay between adaptation and stress. An example of this that many of us are probably familiar with is the small but healthy hypothesis, which asserted that the low birth weight observed in populations in South America and other environs was a functional adaptation to limited food resources. The infusion of political economic theory into such analyses helped to render visible factors that clearly pointed to such biological change as reflecting a health disparity rather than some positive adaptation to one's environment, especially when considering the variable distribution of resources for acquiring food across the globe. This political economic understanding of the adaptation stress dynamic, or what came to be known as the adaptation stress dynamic, therefore contributed to our understanding of differences in health between populations and within populations, as in part reflecting variable, if not inequitable, distributions of resources and power. Therefore, human biology should be understood as a biological and cultural state of being. This means that both social and physiological environments can have equally profound impacts on human health. Related to that, if human biology is informed by both the biological and cultural context in which human beings live, then it follows that the human body is both a historical text and material record of lived experience. The point of interrogation here being the treatment of soft and hard tissues of the body solely as records of the biological and evolutionary history of human beings. Rather, the biological record is socially embedded and therefore a record of human interactions and social relations. Finally, historical analyses of the different modes of interpreting human biological variation in health have pointed toward the bearing that the subject position of the individual researcher has upon the specific methodologies used in the investigative process, as well as the analytical frameworks used to understand those data connections. Did it go? Oh, yes. Okay. The point being that science is indeed a social practice. Biocultural understanding of human variation also recognizes that science is a social practice. And you see the point of interrogation being the objectivity of the scientific method as well as the scientists. Understanding that health and variation has both a biological and a cultural context facilitated the development of different investigative tracks within 20th century biological anthropology, one of which is African American biohistory and social history. This investigative track is significant in light of the historical treatment and use of African Americans and or African American remains as research subjects, primarily used to construct or amplify the reality of racial difference and racial hierarchies. And I have here some just points about African American biohistory and social history, that it is an important site for the interdisciplinary study of health and enslaved African and descendant populations in the Americas, and that it helps to illustrate the longitudinal impacts of racism and discrimination on biological well-being. Understanding the human biology of African and African descendant populations outside of the context of race is therefore an important scientific and political project within biological anthropology, because it serves to redress an intellectual record within the discipline that did not take into account or did not consider the treatment and or subject position of African and African descendant populations in the process of understanding health and disease patterns. This is a key point of identification for me as someone who identifies as African American as well as a biological anthropologist. I see this as part of both a scientific, intellectual exercise and a political project through which I express my resistance to racially embedded understandings of human biological variation, which I do consider to be something that persists, and hence my points of interrogation that I'll present to you that my research partner Jennifer and I are exploring. Kind of moving on, with that said, to the specifics of the normative frameworks that we're interrogating. The recognition of science as a social practice has been used to interrogate the subject position of researchers and social and political ideologies. And so, for instance, you know, we have now lots of writing that shows how it is that, for instance, when Samuel Morton was doing his work on Crania Americana and all of that, that it wasn't just a matter of him engaging in objective scientific practice, but that his research, the way he carried out the research, was informed by prevailing sociopolitical ideologies. But I have to responsibly say that we know that Janet Monge and researchers at University of Pennsylvania have actually contested that and are arguing that the science was not necessarily the problem. So that in and of itself isn't as simple as we'd like to see it. Nonetheless, the recognition of science as a social practice has been used to interrogate the subject position of researchers and the social and political ideologies that influence them, but this interrogation has less often been extended to examining research methodologies and questions in which biological anthropologists engage as social constructs that serve to maintain the dogmatic authority of science. As such, the main points of interrogation for our work are the normative frameworks to which population samples, in our opinion, continue to be subjected, and how that reinscribes the dogma of scientific authority, as well as the implications of and the value and worth of individuals by way of determining their utility in answering particular research questions based upon how statistically manipulatable they are, for instance. And so our points of interrogation for our study, as I mentioned, are temporal, spatial, distributional, and ethno-racial normativities. Our point is that while biocultural analyses have certainly moved away from treating conditions of inequality as naturalized states that are devoid of particular historical social context, and although it is indeed the case that these studies and this research has moved away from emphasizing homogeneity within and between populations, we argue that the next stage in the development of a critical approach to studying human biology should be a move away from normativity, which we see as being something very different from moving away from homogeneity. Talking about the general characteristics, yes, what I wanted to do before diving into the general, before diving into our points of interrogation, I wanted to give you a sense of how it is that African American, the biological state of African Americans and African descendant populations is generally presented. And I wanted to highlight this because one of the points that we are making in our writing is that we shouldn't just see these characteristics as presentation of data, but they're actually these discursive maneuvers that serve to kind of re-inscribe a particular normativity and fixity as it relates to understanding what the health of African descendant populations looks like. So, some general health characteristics that you are always going to see, or very often will see, high infant and child mortality, nutritional deficiency, infectious disease burden, activity-related degenerative change, trauma, musculoskeletal stress, and all of these things are typically connected to disenfranchisement, substandard living environments, and limited employment opportunities. Okay. And to highlight a couple of studies, I won't go through all of these. One very well-known one is a study of the first African Baptist church skeletal population. Some of the very kind of general characteristics that we see in the population sample, periodic bouts of nutritional deficiency, high frequencies of trauma and activity stress, high infant mortality from diarrheal diseases. However, in kind of moving toward a more nuanced study of the human biology of these populations, they found that this population, the first African Baptist church population of African Americans, presented better overall health than European upper middle class whites and enslaved communities. And the thinking is that congregational and other forms of communal support had to do with this. Also, there were differences in health according to the date of burial. So individuals at the burial site who died prior to 1841 had less nutritional deficiency and growth disruption. And this is something I point toward as an example of trying to kind of destabilize these temporal normativities that are often used in bioarchaeological studies as it relates to kind of treating the population sample as one being situated in a particular place in space and time. Another one is Cedar Grove, which is a population sample from Arkansas. General characteristics that are very common to the presentation of African American and African descendant health. Inadequate diet throughout slavery's reconstruction and post-reconstruction periods. The amount of physical labor was indeed consistent throughout the time periods. However, taking a more nuanced perspective, a comparative study with a skeletal series from Dallas, Texas, showed subadult stress levels is a fancy word for germs, as we say. subadult stress levels increased from early to late period burials. And this points toward a segment of the late period sample showing evidence of less stress. And the thinking is that that is a byproduct of some modicum of social and economic improvement having to do with rural to urban transition. And this is something that I point toward as an example of moving away from a kind of spatial normativity in which samples are treated in a particular space that perhaps in which they were found. But allowing them to kind of move through space and move through time in a way that's more appropriate to what perhaps was going on during their lifetime. Finally, the New York African Burial Ground, some very general, kind of common, generally expected characteristics, high infant mortality, evidence of growth disruption on the skeleton, evidence of malnutrition on the skeleton, evidence of infectious disease on the skeleton, high degree of activity stress as well. However, looking at it from a more nuanced perspective, found less evidence of childhood malnutrition and disease in adults compared to other African-American skeletal samples. Also, artifacts, dental modifications, and other aspects of the skeletal record indicate that this is likely due to the African nativity of certain individuals in the population. So, in other words, the assumption was that in the skeletons that we found, colloquially speaking, that looked very nice, that were very pretty, we assumed that these are individuals who had an African nativity and who did not grow up under the stresses of slavery. However, what Joseph Jones, who's completing his dissertation at UMass Amherst, under Alan Goodman has found is that there was a continued use of dental modifications and based on the exposure to lead, that he's found the differential, rather, levels of lead exposure that he's found in some of his dental samples. He posits, rather, that some of the individuals that we assume were born in Africa were actually born in the United States, which is absolutely fascinating in terms of, you know, kind of looking at this picture of what resistance looks like, helping to expand our scope of what African descendant health looks like. So we're all really excited for him to complete his dissertation, and many of us make sure to have him come speak to our classes and all that whenever whenever we can. So with that said, our main points of interrogation are these normative frameworks to which population samples are subjected, that while, as we saw in those previous slides, we are moving toward a more nuanced perspective of health, these are things that we see that manage to persist. Number one, distributional normativity. The point of interrogation being that the research value of skewed population samples is limited. In other words, how closely a population sample reflects a normal population distribution, that lovely bell curve, largely determines its worth, because that has implications for what sorts of statistical manipulations that you can do. As a result, collections like the Cobb skeletal sample, which is very skewed for age, very skewed for sex in that it has mostly men, it's mostly adults, are typically used in small parts of these collections, rather are used as comparative data rather than taking into consideration what it is that skewed distribution tells us in terms of social context. Just because, in other words, a collection doesn't reflect a normal population distribution, it really should not limit its worth. That skewness tells us something about the social context, and that needs to be rendered visible. And some of the things that it tells us about, I have here interlocking hierarchies of gender, race, sex, class, and sexuality. And I have a reference to the osteological paradox, which I'm not going to get into right now. If there's time during our discussion, we can get into that. Second point of interrogation is chronological normativity. The point of interrogation being that skeletal collections are typically organized according to specific chunks of time, like date of birth, which is what DOB stands for, or date of death. And this poses some difficulty to connecting population samples to the broader cultural processes and formations in which they were definitely embedded, such as migratory patterns or what have you. For instance, the Cobb collection, and Jeff mentioned it, it's in my dissertation, it's in papers I've written. The Cobb collection is made up of some of the poorest Washingtonians dating between blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. You know what? They're not really Washingtonians. I know, right? Well, it's on everybody's website. It's in Black and White Forever, by way of so many people. When I was doing my dissertation research and I was looking at the morgue records for these individuals, the duration of residence in the district ranged from one day to a lifetime. Wow. You know, and if this is the case in the Cobb collection, I can assure you it's the case in the Terry collection and all these other collections that we use as well. So this is why it's very important that this particular aspect of normativity be disrupted, because we really are kind of missing out on, we're kind of minimizing the explanatory and transformative power of these data sets. Speaking of the Terry Collection, I wanted to read something to you. The Terry Collection is another population sample that is often used in, or at least referenced, in African American biohistorical studies. In comparison to the labeled biased nature of most African descendant skeletal samples, the Terry Collection is labeled as being more demographically balanced. You'll often see it referred to as being more demographically balanced. In the interest of constructing a population sample reflecting a more normal distribution, the skeletons of whites, blacks, and females were added over time. And so the Terry Skeletal Collection has kind of multiple modes of identification. There are some skeletons that just have a number, some that have a number and an R, and some that have a number and a double R. And these all refer to when it is that those skeletons were added to the sample to make it more demographically balanced. So therefore, what could be referred to as the organic distribution of the sample reflecting specific historical moments and social context of the collection has been obscured in the interest of or for the sake of statistical integrity. That distributional normativity makes the pursuit of a normal population distribution seem objective and or more scientific speaks to how it is that normativities work to distribute power inequitably between researchers and subjects. Anthropologist and science and technology studies scholar Kim Tallbear makes a very compelling argument that underscores this point. In her discussion regarding the imposition of Native American identities through scientific practice, she notes that research subjects merely serve as the raw materials for the production of scientific knowledge. This positioning of research subjects as raw materials is a byproduct of racializing both scientists and research subjects in particular ways that allow for the category of whiteness to be enacted through the subjectivity of the scientist. So in other words, whiteness is not just associated with European ancestry, but also rationality and modernity. Oh, I'm all out of order. Chronological normativity. The point of interrogation being skeletal collections are typical. Spatial. There we go. The point of interrogation being, this might get off my notes, being the attribution of a skeletal sample to a particular locale. Now, again, I mentioned that the Cobb collection is noted as being something, a collection that is made up of the poorest Washingtonians. Individuals, again, are not necessarily tied to the places or locales in the way that attribution implies. And so it goes for, as I mentioned, the Terry sample as well. That's a collection that is housed at Washington University, or was established at Washington University in St. Louis, and it's now at the National Museum of Natural History, and it was started in St. Louis, but again, these individuals show the same kinds of byproducts of migration and what have you that we see in the Cobb collection. And finally, ethno-racial normativity, the point of interrogation being referring to the collection by the predominantly represented group. When I was showing you the slide of the Cobb collection, I purposefully left out specs on the quote-unquote racial makeup or ethnic makeup of the collection because it's referred to as some of the poorest African-American Washingtonians, when, however, there are whites in the collection, and not just, you know, white whites, because we know that's a very new term, but European immigrants. All right, and so this ethno-racial normativity that's imposed on these population samples erases the full composition of population samples, which obscures really important biocultural contexts. Oh, that's my last slide. I'll save that. That's like Frederick Douglass, big face. We're going to save that for the punch. So I will end with kind of bringing all of these normativities together in a brief discussion about repatriation and reburial. So building upon my and Jennifer's mutual interest in this problem of data organization, We've also followed, or we're attempting to follow, queer theory's trajectory in questioning or investigating the political implications of the presented stability and permanence of these categories. In the case of our work, we're looking at how it bears on or how it serves to support a particular racial politics within the discipline that contributes to maintaining a particular literary and methodological canon, as well as, and arguably most importantly, how that presented stability and permanence impacts the daily lives of people among groups historically situated as research subjects. With that said, a key issue regarding the development of a critical humanistic study of human biology is repatriation and reburial. Most importantly, this is an issue situated at the next of these normativities that I mentioned, and so that's why I want to end by addressing it and hope that we can kind of have a discussion about it afterwards, time permitting, since we are all trying to roll out. In addition to using our interrogations, for instance, to employ multiple or various organizational schemes, we also intend to extend our framework to consider the implications for repatriation and reburial as an entrenched component of a critical and humanistic methodology, which I mentioned before. For instance, we mentioned operating outside of the normative categories of date of birth and date of death to open up possibilities for understanding the human biologies of actors moving through space by way of migratory patterns and other formations. These interrogations are also appropriate to consider for the purpose of destabilizing the assumed, and here's where some of our colleagues get very upset at us, the assumed natural permanence of laboratory spaces as repositories for skeletal remains. Is it the case that skeletal collections such as the Cobb collection, such as the Terry collection, should be always already reference collections that are not allowed to move through time along with the discipline? We argue no. In kind of maintaining these normativities, we are not able to consider the purpose that the collection served when they were first established versus their explanatory and transformative potential now, which may not lie in them continuing to remain in a laboratory in a cabinet. For instance, the Cobb collection, as I mentioned to you, was established to assist African Americans with entering into discussions about race biology and racial typology. And so at the time that it was established, it was indeed this really important kind of counter-hegemonic, you know, act. But does it serve that same purpose now as it exists? That's a question that I think needs to be answered, and I don't believe, and we don't believe, that the answer necessarily lies in a bunch of bioanthropologists getting together and answering the question. This is something of interdisciplinary import. You know, how is it that, is there a way to maintain skeletal populations but allow them to move through worlds and hands? Again, thinking back to these kind of temporal normativities and spatial normativities, one of the things that perhaps needs to be considered is that in moving through time and space, perhaps these skeletal collections need to move into the hands of people who identify as descendants. This is certainly something that happened with the New York African Burial Ground Project. And so referencing Mark Mack again and his untimely passing, one of the things that he was going to be spearheading, the part of our project he was going to be spearheading, rather, was developing a repatriation protocol with community members in Washington, D.C., to perhaps return some of the skeletal remains of individuals who were actually D.C. residents to relatives who perhaps are still living in the area. So, in other words, we're kind of questioning in multiple ways, by way of looking at these normativities, the justification for maintaining the Cobb collection as is for the next decades. In conclusion, seriously, we're arguing that the examination of these normative frameworks is a valuable theoretical exercise in which bioanthropologists should engage as part of their research practice. So, you know, kind of going back to Cobb's position, we shouldn't be leaving this to the cultural anthropologist. As biological anthropologists, this should be part of what we do. It turns a much-needed critical eye toward the research methodologies we use to explore the social and political dimensions of health. In doing so, we open up spaces of dialogue with each other and colleagues in other subdisciplines regarding the unique position biological anthropologists occupy at the nexus of science and social science. These communications, in turn, facilitate shared intra-disciplinary research that unravels the social and biological complexities of illness, disease, disability, and daily life. And so I want to end, kind of closing with a quote from Douglas. I got dinged for this when I showed it before, but I think it's really powerful, so I'm sticking with it. What the masters in natural science have done, it kind of runs through our science, social science, you know, tensions. What the masters in natural science have done for man in the physical world, the masters of social science may yet do for him in the moral world. Science now tells us when storms are in the sky and when and where their violence will be most felt. Why may we not yet know with equal certainty when storms are in the moral sky and how to avoid their desolating force? Thank you.